Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Ellen Van Vechten is an attorney turned alcohol and drug counselor who examines the disruption that many families endure when addiction impacts their lives. Based in part on her own family's journey, Van Vechten explains the science of addiction, the theory of treatment, and the 12-step model of recovery in her new book. It's called On the Other Side of Chaos, Understanding the Addiction of a Loved One. And we just have Ellen Van Vechten on the line. Her new book is On the Other Side of Chaos, Understanding the Addiction of a Loved One. And good morning to you, Ellen.
Oh, good morning, Lynn. Thank you so much for having me on and giving me the opportunity to talk about this important issue.
First of all, I want to start off with your story. I mean, you were an attorney, and I suspect that it was with the very close contact that you had with a loved one experiencing addiction that you eventually came over to undergo training, and now you're a drug and alcohol counselor. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. I experienced the chaos myself, parenting a teenager who was struggling with addictive disease for many years. And as I went through his treatment programs with him as a family member, I saw how many people are struggling and the chaos that's brought into your life when suddenly a loved one is suffering from a substance use disorder. And so I thought, I want to do something and try and give back and learn more. And I went back to school to obtain a certification as a counselor. And that just kind of reemphasized to me how much knowledge helped me to deal with the situation. The more I learned, the better I was able to cope. And I want to pass that on to others that have a similar experience.
Right. So the way that you organize your book, it's very fact-based. It's, you know, you list out various drugs and what to look for, and you talk about denial, and you talk about acceptance, and in, you know, a pretty, I guess, clinical way, but I think it's a very thorough look at many, many different things. As I was saying before we brought you on, you know, talking about hallucinogens and, you know, even things like depressants and a variety of drugs and then alcohol. But, you know, you have some pretty staggering statistics about how many people in our country are currently experiencing some sort of addiction to drugs and or alcohol.
Yes, it's an epidemic, as we hear so often. The studies indicate that more than 20 million Americans have a substance use disorder. And when I think of all of the family and friends of those 20 million, there's just a vast number of Americans that are struggling with this on a daily basis.
Ellen, I'm curious about what you believe through your work kind of contributes to this space of chaos that happens once somebody is faced with addiction and becomes addicted and becomes an addict. And it not only affects the addict, but it affects the entire family system. And then, you know, there are circles out from there, friends, and it can really ripple out into an entire community, somebody's entire network. And do you think that chaos is a result of the misalignment of what families expect or hope for and what actually happens? Kind of, you know, life happens, and if we have certain expectations and we're rooted in those expectations and they're written in stone, it can be incredibly disruptive when life happens.
Absolutely. Our expectations for our loved ones, you know, we have a dream for those we love. We think that they will have success and a happy career path and rewarding personal relationships. And we see people change so much when they are under the influence of drugs. And it destroys that existing relationship, and you're faced with someone you don't really know anymore. So And in dealing with recovery, those expectations come back up. We need to let go of some of those dreams and embrace what we can, a healthy future in recovery, and let go of some of the other more specific plans for someone else.
And how did it affect you in your personal experience? Can you kind of walk us through what happened and sort of put you on this path?
Well, I think my experience is common to so many people and probably many of your listeners. When you see a child that has been part of the family and everything has been going along well, and all of a sudden there changes and you don't know that person anymore, and you discover that they're using substances and putting their health and well-being at risk, and you have guilt and fear and confusion, and it's hard to understand how this happened in your own family. So, and then you're just constantly worried that they will come to harm or cause harm to someone else. And you, at that point, you don't have the tools to try and deal with it, to cope with it, and to make some good decisions about what the next step should be. And that's where I'm trying to give people that information so they'll have the tools to decide what's best for them and for their family.
And Ellen, is a component of this, you know, it seems like an easy, and there are no easy, there are no easy answers in a situation like this. There are no several silver bullets that will take care of everything. But obviously, you know, we've attempted through years and generations to regulate these alcohol and drugs. You know, drugs are illegal unless prescribed, and if you use them, even if they're prescribed in ways that they're not meant for, that's illegal. And alcohol has age restrictions, and we have all sorts of, you know, punitive measures if you overindulge in even alcohol when it's legal for you to consume it. And yet we have, you know, people who are addicts. Do you think that if we were to remove alcohol and drugs, addicts would find other means of altering their state? And is there something deeper that's the root cause that causes people to, you know, use drugs and alcohol? And if those were not in existence, they would find something else?
Well, I think that the presence of alcohol and drugs is pervasive in our society. And I don't know that attempts to combat the influx of drugs have stopped the problem. And indeed, those trafficking illegal drugs will keep changing the formulations in an effort to avoid detection and prosecution. So I think that the supply is something we have to deal with. But what's important is the recognition of the disease process. There are many different reasons why some people may start to experiment with drugs or alcohol, which is a different discussion. But once they make that decision and they're experimenting and they continue to use, biology takes over and reroutes the pathways of the brain and reinforces drug use so that even the sights and sounds that remind a user of the past high will cue them to and reactivate their desire to continue to use. So it becomes less of a choice, but more of a compulsion. So I think understanding the significance of science and biology, we see how this happens to some individuals.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Ellen Van Vechten. Her new book is On the Other Side of Chaos, Understanding the Addiction of a Loved One. And I might say, you know, even though your tagline talks about the addiction of a loved one, you know, this is great for anyone, especially if you have questions about yourself or if you're experiencing addiction at this moment in time. let's go a little bit more into addiction as a brain disease that... you know, the science behind addiction. And I guess I'm wondering, and I've heard various conversations on this, but I'm not sure what the answer is. Are you born with that possible disease, the brain disease? It just is latent until it is triggered, or is it something that is developed?
The science does show that there's a very significant genetic factor in terms of predisposing an individual to develop this addictive disease. It's between 40 and 70% of the risk for developing a substance use disorder is based on genetic factors. But the causation of addiction is not a simple cause and effect, or if you have the gene, you'll get it, and if you don't have the gene, you won't, because there's so many environmental influences mm-hmm. on the development of the disease. Even age at initial use is a factor in whether an individual is likely to become addicted. The teenagers, their brains are not fully developed, and they're more vulnerable to the toxic effect of the chemicals on their brain development. So early onset of use is a factor in developing the disease, as is a history of trauma, neglect, mm-hmm. or domestic abuse. That may encourage individuals to seek a release through the use of alcohol and drugs, kind of setting off the process in those individuals. We see some of our veterans are also suffering mm-hmm. from substance abuse disorders that are related to the trauma they experience, and in some cases, the post-traumatic stress disorders they are suffering from. If an individual grows up in a community or a household where drug use is prevalent, they're likely to experiment and start to use drugs. So there's so many different factors. It's a very complex process.
Yeah. Let's talk a little more about the disease model of addiction. And you say in your book that this disease model is actually the foundation for our understanding of treatment and recovery, and that it also supports empathy for the addict. And I think this is kind of crucial, especially when you're dealing with loved ones, you know, supporting them with how far they've come instead of how far they have, you know, yet to go, or if there's a relapse, there's a certain way of dealing with that.
Yes, absolutely. I think that so often if a loved one suffering from the disease, many of us feel like we did something. And to understand it, it's science and biology, and that what you're saying or doing is not causing your loved one to develop the disease. So it kind of helps to ease that guilt. It also helps to explain why they don't just stop. I mean, it makes so much sense to us when drugs and alcohol are destroying someone's future that they just stop, but they can't because of the biological compulsion to do so.
Ellen, what about the aspect of not only the addict who's in recovery, but also those who are directly involved or affected? And maybe the simple way would be to say the family system is also in recovery. Could you talk about how that works as well?
Yes, I think that addiction is often referred to as a family disease because it so destroys the foundations of the family relationship. And looking at the title of the book, On the Other Side of Chaos, you can also think that the chaos spreads. When we are consumed with worry and guilt and fear about a loved one's behavior, our own lives become unmanageable. And we're powerless, of course, over another's use of alcohol or drugs, but we need to step back and take care of ourselves and foster habits that will contribute to our own peace and serenity. And so I think that the recovery of the family member is a parallel process and a very important one. It leads to acceptance of what we can change, which is only ourselves and the way we respond to things, and what we cannot change, which is what others do.
And I guess my follow-up question is related to that, and it's about, you know, when treatment and recovery is successful or reaches a healthy outcome. Using the term successful is always a dangerous thing to do, I think, but reaches what we all hope for as a healthy outcome, and how that, You've used examples of people going into treatment repeatedly and attempting recovery, but finding themselves back in addiction and going through treatment repeatedly. So is there something you can point to that would indicate, success versus failure?
Well, I think it is a process, and it's often not a straight line. And what we hope for our loved ones is that they do find recovery, a lifetime recovery. But relapses do occur, and sometimes that will kind of redirect someone. They'll realize that they are powerless, and they need to make additional changes in their lifestyle, or they need additional treatment. And I think that sometimes treatment is cumulative, especially with young people that, as they're mature, they may relapse and require additional treatment as their developmental progress moves forward. There's always hope, and time in treatment, more time in treatment is always beneficial. So I guess what I'm saying is there's hope, and that there's options and tools we can use, and in the hope that our loved ones will ultimately find recovery.
So, Ellen, one of the things I like that you do in your book that I've sort of already mentioned, but this very organized way in which you present the information, one of your chapters is about the criteria for diagnosis of addictive disorders. And you start off with denial, and you go through this organized way of figuring out if someone's in denial. What are those ways?
Well, I think I tried to provide information on what are the criteria for having a diagnosis as a substance use disorder, because, it's common sometimes people will drink, or there'll be one incident. And what distinguishes that from somebody that actually has a disease that needs attention? And so there are a list of factors that give you like a checkpoint to see, well, where might we be on this scale? But the actual diagnosis is something that needs to be done by a professional. So I'm not urging that we self-diagnose or that we try and diagnose our loved ones, but it helps to understand what makes it something that needs treatment, and what was it just an incident in college? Where does it become a problem? And the criteria help us objectively determine that, so that if you have a certain number of criteria are met, you're said to have a mild substance use disorder. And if many more are met, you're said to have a severe substance use disorder. And severe disorder is kind of the same thing as what we used to call addiction. So someone with a mild disorder would benefit perhaps from counseling and being made aware of the risks that they're engaged in. And they may then return to a healthy pattern of living without a significant treatment intervention.
Right. I guess I always say, as someone who's never been addicted to nicotine, say, with cigarettes, I say, it's simple. You just don't start, which I realize it's much more complicated than that. But if you if you are keeping checks on yourself, and you start off with these very basic, red flags that would indicate impaired control, which is sort of the beginnings of a mild addiction. And in this case, I'm reading from where you talk about alcohol use disorder. And there are these very simple things, craving or a strong desire or urge to use alcohol, taking alcohol in larger amounts than you had planned, a desire to cut down, followed by, sort of an unsuccessful cutting down. These are the sorts of red flags. And is it enough to that we should all kind of look at those little red flags and not go beyond that point?
Well, I think that is helpful. And there are other resources that on the website of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, where you can kind of have a checklist to see, do I have a problem? Those are available on the web on at websites as well. And I think with the progression of addiction, it's largely dependent on concepts of tolerance and withdrawal. So that if you are using alcohol, for example, if you continue to use it over time and more of it over time, it to get the same effect, you have to drink more alcohol. So that's your body is developing a tolerance to alcohol, and to reach the same feelings, you need to drink more and more of it. That's an indicator of the concern, a concerning indicator. And withdrawal, if you stop using it, what does your body react in its most serious forms? Withdrawal would be the severe shaking and the delirium tremens that is associated with advanced alcohol. But those responses are, they're on the scale as well. The checklist of criteria, I think there are 12 different criteria for a diagnosis. So these are all factors that play into whether or not someone has a need for some medical intervention. And I think maybe a simple test is it interfering with your daily life? Is it causing you to perform less effectively in your life functions in work or in the family? If you're starting to experience consequences from your use, that is a, you know, that's a very strong warning sign.
Ellen, as a parent with children, I'm trying to think of what it would be like. I'm trying to put myself in the shoes that you have described in that place of chaos. And is that part of what you're trying to, the message you're trying to send people is the depth of the chaos? Because I can't even imagine it. You know, my kids are 30 and 28, and I'm kind of through that. But, well, you're never through it. But I'm trying to imagine what that chaos would look like if one of my children struggled with some form of severe addiction.
Well, it's the person that you once knew is gone. You know, a factor that parents can look for is school performance changing? Are their groups of friends changing? Are they becoming withdrawn and secretive? I mean, there's all sorts of things that might suggest you want to look into the situation further. But it's life as you know it is doesn't continue, and your dreams for the future are shattered. But my thought is that when people are in that, you know, they're struggling for a way out. They're struggling to find information and what do I do? How do I stop it and take care of the situation? So that's where I think the more information, true scientific information and discussion of what treatment is, how it works, and how to find it, and what are those steps you want to take when your loved one, when you see them teetering off course, that's where I'm trying to get people some tools so they can manage the chaos.
The book is On the Other Side of Chaos, Understanding the Addiction of a Loved One. Ellen Van Vechten, thank you for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you very much for having me.